welcome to the Joseph Campbell Audio Collection. This talk is called The Individual in Oriental Mythology. It's the second selection in the series entitled Mythology and the Individual. And now, Joseph Campbell.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a particularly difficult subject this evening, since, as you know, there are at least three distinct Orients. There's the Orient of the Near East, the Levant, Arabian world, and the world of the Christian and Jewish traditions, and earlier perhaps the Persian Zoroastrian religion are the distinguished representatives. There's the world of India, with Hinduism, Jainism, and Buddhism as its typical religious examples. And there's the world of the Far East, which includes those two quite different worlds of China and Japan. Furthermore, the subject is somewhat difficult because, at least as I see the problem, the idea of the individual, as we understand it in the European Western world, does not exist in any of these. To make myself clear, let me pause for a minute to say a few words about what seems to me to be the Western idea of the individual. I will take a few rather well-known examples to illustrate the fact. Carl Jung, in his works, speaks of the integration of the personality, and he uses the word individuation rather frequently. And to make clear what he means, he points out that each one of us is, by his society, invited to play a certain role, a certain social role, in order to function. We play roles. These roles he calls personae, from the Latin word for mask worn by an actor. We all have to put on a mask of some sort in order to function in the society. And even those who choose not to function in the society, to revolt from the society, put on masks too. They wear certain insignia, you might say, that indicate I am in revolt. One can be impressed by a persona, by a mask. For example, if one meets a person and is talking to him and thinks one is beginning to establish some kind of rapport, and then learns, let us say, that this is the distinguished ambassador from such and such a place, the mask comes in front of that person and a certain awe in your relationship to him. And this person becomes what Jung calls a mana personality, a personality with magical power, so that you are not talking directly to him. In order to be individuated, in order to be an individual, we must distinguish between ourselves and the mask that we wear. Now, this mask goes very deep. It includes moral ideas. It includes judgment systems. These archetypes for action have been impressed upon us by our society. Now, I take Jung's idea of the individuation as a rather clean-cut example of an Occidental ideal, that one should put on the mask and take it off when you come home. In the evening, are you still Mr. President, or do you leave that in the office? If you keep your mask on, you know what we say of such a person. He is a stuffed shirt. The personality gradually disappears. And this is a particular disaster if one becomes impressed by one's own mask. Here we have a real mirage phenomenon. Nobody there. Now let me say that the typical ideal in the Orient is that one should become identified with the mask. The whole pattern of education throughout the Orient is believe what you're told, do what you're told, do not ask questions. For an Occidental teaching Oriental students, it is absolutely bewildering, the submissiveness. For an Oriental teaching Occidental students, the challenges are shocking. There is no respect for the professor, qua professor. Now in the wonderful Inferno of Dante, as he wandered through these hell pits, he recognized all of his friends there, as we should recognize ours if we went to that place. And proceeding through purgatory and even to heaven, he knew who those people were. Their personalities, their individual personalities, were preserved even in the afterworld. The personality here is a permanent part, permanent entity. You are born once, you live once, you are that. There is an identification with the body. In the Greek world, when the heroes go to the underworld, again, they recognize their friends. However, in the Oriental hells and heavens, whether of the Buddhist or the Hindu or the Jain type, you do not recognize anybody. They are not the same person they were on Earth. Now let me make a point. The hero in Europe, in the Greek tragedy, in Dante's Commedia, in Jung's idea of the individual, is this individual, this temporal being here now. In the farther east of India and China and Japan, the hero is, now I'll use the crucial word, the reincarnating monad. That entity which goes through bodies, puts them on and puts them off as clothes. This is a continuing theme in the Orient, in the Farther Orient. You are not this body. You are not this ego. You are to think of this as merely something put on to be thrown away again. A fundamental distinction here between our European concept of the individual and that of, let us say, India and the Far East. The reincarnating principle makes quite unimportant this particular temporal phenomenon that we now are. There is an expansion of the ego concept or an annihilation of it, so that it is not identified with this temporal phenomenon here now, but with the reincarnating principle. Now the differences from belief to belief, which I'm going to try to describe, have to do with the identification of the monad. What is it that reincarnates? Now let me take the next point. One of the most impressive and wondrous things about the Oriental religions is the concept of the round of existence. These eons that come and go, so that worlds come into being and worlds go out of being. This is an idea that originated very, very long ago in the Near East. As you know, our civilizations, whether European or Oriental, have all derived from a Near Eastern base. It was in the great zone of Palestine, Syria, Iran, and Iraq that the earliest agricultural and pastoral communities developed. From these, there spread forth this strongly based agricultural, pastoral, agrarian society on which the later civilizations are based. Then about 3500 BC, in that area, the mathematically calculable movements of the five visible planets and the sun and moon were recognized. And the idea developed of a mathematical order underlying the whole universe. We have eons mathematically calculated so that after a certain long passage of time, the whole world dissolves. Then it comes into being again, and then it dissolves. You know the old story, in Hesiod already, of the four great ages of gold, silver, bronze, and iron, and then they come forth again, and then they go again. In the Eddas of the medieval Germanic peoples, the world comes into being and then goes out of being, and throughout India and the Far East, this is so. Now, when the world does that, when you have this pattern of eternal recurrence, there is nothing you or I can do to change the situation. Individual initiative is of no use whatsoever. It has no value whatsoever. It is an intrusion upon the scene. Just as the sun rises on schedule and sets on schedule, as the moon waxes and wanes, as the plants grow and die, so must you live. In India, this idea is the idea of dharma, the idea of that duty, that virtue, which is yours as a result of your birth. Now, in India, this dharma is understood in terms of caste. That is to say, each order of society has its very strict rules, and you are born into that, and you live according to this caste system. It is thought that as a result of earlier births, you are perfectly ready to be born on that level, so to say. Consequently, the moral system, the persona, the mask that is supplied you by your social group is perfectly appropriate to your character. Otherwise, you would not have been born on that level. Now, there is no need for a god to judge you and put you in your spot. This happens automatically, as it were, by specific gravity. The weight of your soul, the spiritual weight of it, determines what level of the social order you will come in on. And your duty is simply to do as told. In the old texts, the laws of Manu and the institutes of Vishnu and so forth, the detailed description of how you are to behave, how long your sleeves are to be, how many times you're to sneeze in the morning. Every little detail of life is described to an iota. And the opportunity to think, what would I like to do now? What would I like to be? And all that kind of thing is not allowed. The slightest infringement is rigorously punished. The punishment system is extremely strict. The society is very serious about this. In the farther east, in China and Japan, there is the idea of the Tao, the way, the cosmic order, which is described in terms different from those of India, but nevertheless amounts to essentially the same thing, namely that there is a cosmic rhythm, a cosmic order, and that is our nature, and the real goal of life is to know how to function in unison with the Tao, so that our spontaneity is the spontaneity of nature itself. This is a noble, wonderful ideal. It is an ideal of self-giving. The idea of ego in these societies is regarded as the diabolical principle, the negative principle. One follows from beginning to end this story of annihilate ego. cancel ego. And in fact, the ego is given no opportunity whatsoever to develop. In the Indian philosophies, there is a very well-known classification of the goals for which men live. These are called the four ends of life. There are three for which people live in the world, in society, and there is one for which people leave society and go into the forest. The three for which people live in society are the first, virtue, dharma, that you should perform the laws imposed upon you by your caste. And the other two are the natural desires of any organism. They are aggression or achievement, it's called artha, and delight or pleasure. These are the natural drives of what Freud calls the id, namely the simple biological energy of the psyche. These id drives, desire for pleasure, desire for achievement, are to be realized under the ceiling of the Dharma. In other words, I want versus thou shalt. I want, thou shalt. These are the motives, I would say, of the nursery. There is no development here of an individual at all. There is no provision made for what Freud calls ego development. The ego principle, I principle, is contaminated by id principle, according to this system. They cohere. I means I want in the Orient. Whereas in Jung's and Freud's and our Western view in general, there is a dissociation between id and ego. Ego is the principle that links this individual here and now to this situation here and now. You are not to think in terms of clichés. You are not to think that this situation ever happened before. It didn't. It's absolutely unique. Its demands are absolutely unique. The decision has to be made now. Furthermore, as a result of assuming an ego, you assume responsibility for what you do. And that's the next point in the Western idea of the ego that is missing in the Orient. What you do in the Orient is what you do as a soldier. A soldier is not personally responsible for anything that he does under command. He does it because that is the order, and he is simply a good soldier. Similarly, if you are acting according to Dharma, doing just what you're told, there is no personal responsibility on you at all. You do not assume responsibility for anything. Now, I think in the West, the Protestant idea of individual conscience, deciding what God's message is to you through your own conscience, this is a fundamental principle in the West. It has to do with an idea of freedom of will, freedom of conscience, freedom of decision, assumption of personal responsibility. There is none of this in the Orient at all. Now, let me make another point. I want to speak now briefly about a distinction between this first Orient, the Orient of the Levant, from which the biblical tradition comes, and the other Orients of India and the Far East. I've spoken of the great cycles. And I've said these come mathematically. Now the image, the mythological image that is used to describe the coming of the end and then the return is the image of the deluge, the flood. The world sinks in the primordial waters again, in the primordial abyss, and then it comes out in form, and then it goes back, and then it comes out. This happens automatically, mathematically. About 2500 BC, a new version of the deluge appears in the Sumerian texts. The idea is that God, in that case Enlil, sent the deluge in punishment for man's sins. It's a totally different deluge. In this case, you do not have the automatic coming and going. You have a punishment of someone who is guilty. Now, there are enormous implications in this shift of scene. In the first place, a certain sense of wonder and magnitude and glory is lost. There's no question about it. The other is a great, magnificent, wondrous affair. This cosmic being of which we are but morsels. On the other hand, this throws man into a personal relationship to a deity who has free will. The deities in both India and the Far East are agents of the cycle. For the most part, they are, as it were, executives, executing the necessary acts, bringing about the inevitable processes of the cosmic cycle. However, when you have the deity himself sending the flood, himself making the laws, you have a quite different principle in play. And it is at about this time that a very big shift takes place in the whole consciousness of the world west of Iran. This includes the Levant and Europe. It is this. No longer do we think of God and man as mere aspects of a total being, which is the cosmos. God and man become separate from each other and in tension with each other, and God is judging man and acting upon him. Furthermore, God sits, as it were, behind the laws of the universe, not in front of them. In the older system of the great mathematics of the cosmos, God, as I say, is simply the executive, and you have the great natural laws which govern everything. But when you have a God who determines what the laws are to be, who says, let it be so-and-so, and it is so-and-so, and you have a stress on the personality that doesn't exist on the other side. Now, this puts the Levantine Orient into a rather close relationship to the individualism of the West that I've been talking about. However, there is a big distinction to be made. In the Levant, the stress is always on obey. The idea is that this God has given a revelation which is encompassed in a book, in a statement. This goes for Zoroastrianism, goes for Judaism, goes for Islam, goes for every one of the great religions out of the Near East. There is a book. There is a revealed truth. And man does not quibble with that. Man finds out what it says. And the one who does quibble with that is, by definition, an evil person, a person who has lost touch with the truth and is an outcast. Whole races, whole worlds can fall away. In fact, the usual pattern in the Near East is that there is one folk that has received the word, or one tradition, and this is the true tradition. In the Levant, the typical hero is not the individual, nor is it the reincarnating monad. It is the folk or church that carries the truth. The individual is, as it were, an organ of that organism. The Christian is one with all Christians in the organism of Christ, of the church. And the Hebrew community, you have the seed of Abraham and the chosen people who will be vindicated at the end of time, and the individual's relationship to the God is through that community, not a personal one. There must be 10 people present in the idea of the minyan. So there's this idea of the fall and a process of the whole community, and with the community, all that counts, back to the God, and the individual participates in that. The interesting thing in Europe is that this idea has come to Europe from the Orient. You can see it happening in the early Christian communities, the attempt to fuse the two ideas of the individual and the community. And I would say that you can see the joint in the Christian notion of two judgments, the personal judgment and the general judgment. Each of us at death is judged. That's the individual problem. And at the end of the world, there's a second judgment where everybody comes back for a grand second judgment when the world ends and all of this. Here we have the two traditions brought together. Now let me sum up briefly what I've tried to point out so far and then move on to the farther east. In Europe, I would say, we have a very strong individualistic tradition which goes back certainly to the Greeks and is to be identified also in the North European pagan traditions of the Celts and the Germans. This comes into relationship in the medieval period in particular with the idea of the community, the chosen people, the group outside of which there is no salvation. The statement made by Ben Gurion a couple of weeks ago, this is an old traditional idea of the Near East entirely. Those who do not reside in this sacred place are said to have no God. There you have the idea of the community as hero, the people of God. And in the further east now, I will bring us to this problem of the reincarnating monad. And I want to begin to create this world for you by telling a story from one of the late Indian Upanishads. This is a story known as the humbling of Indra. Indra is king of the gods. He is the counterpart of Zeus. And in the course of the great cycles, the monster, the great serpent power, accumulated to himself all of the waters of the world so that the world was dissolving. It was dying. And Indra let fly a thunderbolt and exploded this serpent monster, whose name Vritra means the enveloper. Exploded him so that the waters flowed back into the world. And he thought he had done that himself. He was a god. He exploded the monster. The monster blew up. All the waters rushed back. Indra thought, what a great boy am I. He went back to the cosmic mountain, Mount Meru, the Olympus of India, and he noticed all of the great palaces of the gods had fallen into decay. And he thought, I will build a city worthy of myself, the hero who has saved the universe, and I will build a palace worthy of myself. So he called the master craftsman of the gods, Vishvakarman, the maker of all things, and said, I'd like palaces, I'd like lotus ponds, I'd like pagodas, I'd like a great, great thing here, because a great, great thing am I. And Vishvakarman, oh, well, this is perfectly fine, I'll be glad to do this.